I was thinking last night after the talk, which isn't the best way to do it, by the way. You should usually think before you talk. But my mouth operates faster than my brain now. No, in any case. I was thinking last night after the talk. A question was raised, which was a very good one, by one of the French seminarians. I don't know how many French seminarians are here. Two. Well, it was one of two. And the question was, why is not the great age of the neoclassical theater in France considered one of the golden ages of the drama? It was a great period of theater and a great period of drama. It gave us the great tragedians Corneille and Racine, as well as the great comic writer Molière. Molière is best known in the English-speaking world. He's easier to translate, and comedy is easier to perform than tragedy. But Corneille and Racine, great, great dramatists, great writers. And the answer, I think, is simply that the drama in France at that time in the 17th century was very much meant for the court. It was an elite drama. So that if I drew the distinction last night between a golden age of the drama where the entire community from every social level was somehow involved in the experience of theater, you didn't have it with those playwrights. It was much more elite, it was stratified, it was not something that was available for everyone, and it wasn't a means of drawing the community together. The great golden ages of the theater drew the entire community together and gave that community coherence. What it brought to mind to me was this. We've never known anything quite like it in this country. The closest we ever came was in the 20s, 30s, 40s, into the 50s perhaps, when everybody went to the movies. And it was a social experience. Everybody went to the films. But I wouldn't call it a golden age of any art form for this reason. And it's part of the mystery of the modern world we live in. Much as I love film, and I grew up on film, and I have movies that I treasure, film is a bastard art form between art and technology. You take away the technology, you unplug the camera or the player, you shut off the power, and the art is gone. You cannot reproduce it in any way. Should there be a huge catastrophe, all the power is gone, we have nothing left, but we have our little script of the Oresteia, we could perform it. We could still perform it. The greatest art, which is the art of the drama, does not depend on technology. Film does. And it's part of modern man's dependence on electricity. And it makes sense that his primary art form, beginning with movies, heading into television, then into computers, and now into all these little individual screeny devices. I don't even know what they are. I can't keep tweeting and twittering and twerping, and I don't know what they all are. Can't keep up with them all. All are dependent entirely on technology and electricity. If you don't know the great essay by Solange Hertz on electricity called Hell's Amazing Grace, you must read it. Mrs. Hertz and I see her regularly. She's 91 years old now. We have things we disagree on seriously. But being Catholic friends, we can debate them. Usually down in her basement where she pours a very good drink, by the way. God bless her. And what's interesting as well is this. Having written the great essay talking about electricity, the basic notion is this. We know at the beginning of creation, God said, let there be light. We know that one of his primary acts was dividing the day from the night, the light from the darkness, which means God arranged the day. Electricity allows us to decide when the light will be, when it will be day, when it will be night, extend, and that's a temptation. And she claims in that essay, since it's a violation of God's order and God's plan, we must know the source of it. If it's an overturning of God's natural order, we need to be suspicious of the source of it. She has lamps in her house. She's not lunatic. We all live this way. We do it. It's a world we live in. But it pays to ask certain questions about the world we live in. Be aware of it. So in any case, that art form. And the other thing notice about the modern art forms. From the theater, a communal experience, everyone coming together and seeing actors on a stage, and you know there is that interaction between audience and actors. It's a live experience. The film is dead. It's shadows on a screen. There is no life. It can play to an empty theater. It doesn't matter. There is no connection between audience and the performance. None at all. It can never change. It will always be the same. And you take a movie like The Wizard of Oz. I love it. I'm a child at heart. All of those actors in it are dead now. Their shadows are still there flickering on a screen. Should make us a little uneasy. It doesn't. We take it for granted. But we went from that to the television, where you don't even gather together in a theater. The family would sit around a little box together, separated from the neighbors. Then everybody got a TV, and Daddy was in his room, Mommy was in his room, Junior was in his room, Sis was in her room, and the family was divided. And now with the computer, they're even more divided. And now with little twitty, twerping, twittering nonsense, you go out in public, and people don't even look at each other, much less talk to each other. It's this little device. And they walk around bumping heads and walking into trees and light bulbs because they're addicted to this little thing. What is going on is a complete destruction of anything communal, of anything like community. Destroying community, destroying neighborhood, destroying the family, and now destroying even acknowledgement that there are other human beings in the world. It's crazy. Watch out for it. Watch out for it. It's not good. The Greek theater, again, communal. A communal experience, okay? They all came together. They shared something through all the different social strata in their society. I neglected one thing last night. Let me mention it quickly, and I'll tie it into what I think is a principal idea in the Oresteia that we're going to look at as I talk about the play. It's this. I talked about the setup of the stage. You saw, and it's one of the very nice things in the production you're viewing, all of the actors were masked, okay? You didn't have recognizable actors. What you had was actors in masks. It's debatable, and it's an interesting debate, whether it was a partial mask that allowed the mouth to be free or a complete mask that they had to speak through. The version you're seeing, it's a complete mask. Those actors have to get the voice through that little opening. That is technique. That's hard. That's not easy. Complete mask, robes of some kind, occasionally monumental. There is a way in which the characters in Greek plays should resemble living statuary, meaning we are seeing something more than just the merely human. In the very costumes and the masks, the Greek drama is saying to us that there is something in humanity that is higher, mysterious, larger than life, more fascinating, connected with things beyond the commonplace. And that is something we know. It's a profound truth about human beings, about humanity. And one of the dangers, especially in this world, is to get sunk in the everyday and just assume it's all rather dull and we go about our business. And it's to my mind, that frightening phrase that comes, I forget which psalm it's in, you'll probably know, the noonday demon. That noonday demon can simply be boredom, just repetition, of just living a life that becomes empty and dull. What that theatrical experience did was suggested the majesty of humanity. Now, they had something else, and this is what I forgot to mention last night. Part of the costume, not for the chorus. The chorus would appear usually in bare feet. They were on the level ground in bare feet. They were human size, even if they had the masks and the robes. It made them appear to be something more. But the actors other than that wore something called korthunai. Built-up shoes. Platform shoes, not just heels, platform shoes, so that the actors playing the heroes or the noble human characters, Agamemnon, Orestes, Clytemnestra, Cassandra, would quite literally be above the chorus because of the shoes they were wearing, okay? So that if the chorus, bare feet on the stage, maybe 5.5 feet, if they were really tall, maybe 6 feet, and then above them at maybe 7 feet would be those performing the nobility. So visually we had a sense of hierarchy. And when the gods appeared in the final play, the Eumenides, when Apollo appears on stage, when Athena comes on stage, when Hermes comes on stage, they were on exaggerated catharnae, maybe 2 feet tall. Again, technical, you had to work with these. You can't just stumble out on stage in them. But it meant Apollo might stand 8 or 9 feet tall. And when a god was on the stage, you knew a god was on the stage. And of course, the masks for the gods, more elaborate than those worn by the chorus. Point I'm making is this. Visually, the plays were hierarchical. Visually, it suggested movement upward. Movement upward. And what this play in particular moves from, even in terms of the basic conflicts in each of the three parts, we move from, and let me say this just quickly, if you want to understand any play, look at the core conflict. Who's the protagonist? Who's the antagonist? In the Agamemnon, the first part of the Oresteia, the conflict is clearly between Agamemnon, the protagonist, and Clytemnestra, the antagonist, okay? What is the setting? It's in front of the house. I hesitate to call it a domestic drama because it's much more than that, but it is familial. It is the husband versus the wife in front of the house, okay? But it's elevated because they are heroic figures, they're noble, they're higher. The second play in the trilogy, what's the setting? The house is still there. That permanent set, the scaena, is still there. The altar is in front now, though, and made use of. It is not mentioned in the Agamemnon. It is not really a part of the Agamemnon. And Agamemnon's tomb is there. The house is in the background. The focus is on the divine, the altar, the tomb. And that's where most of the action takes place. And the basic conflict is between Orestes and his mother. And we have a different kind of familial drama, not between husband and wife, but between son, the protagonist, and mother, antagonist, who is embodying now a vision, and her vision is revenge. That's what she was after in the first part, and she is committed to it. She has spilled the blood. And at the end of The Libation Bearers, the second part of the trilogy, Orestes is confronted by the Furies and sees the Furies, and suddenly the conflict springs upward, and is now heading towards a divine conflict. What started a marriage conflict in the second play turns into son versus mother, his own blood, her own blood. And this will become an argument in the third part of the play. And then begins to move upward. We don't see the Furies at the end of the second part. Orestes does. And in the third part, the Eumenides, we move from the temple of Apollo at Delphi to Athens. We are actually up on the highest point, the Acropolis, at the temple of Athena, and we end at the Areopagus, okay? All divines, we're in divine settings, if you will, and the conflict is between Apollo, the protagonist, and the Furies, the antagonist. And it has become a war of the gods. A war of the gods. As these plays proceed, the conflict gets greater and greater and greater and moves upward and becomes a divine contest. I'll say much more about that later. But what is happening here? That divine conflict, and that's where we're moving, that's where the whole play is heading, is again suggesting that in the dealings of human beings, the gods are always present. It is one of those insights that the Greeks had. We can call them pagans, but at least they possessed pagan piety to a degree and understood there was a realm of the divine, and that realm of the divine connected intimately with human beings and the lives of human beings, and behind their actions was this enormous realm of the gods. And for a completely secular world, such as the modern world, where man himself has become God, they have no such interest at all. It's one reason the Greeks are... I taught the Greeks more and more in my later years. Because before you could even begin to introduce the principles of the Christian world again, you had to go back to certain basics that the Greeks indeed possess. There is one of them. There is one of them. There is a divine realm. We are connected with it. And one thing I'm going to do now as I go through this is try to show some of those connections. I mentioned yesterday, I was teaching this, teaching the Greek myths, and talking about the business of Dionysus being torn apart, dying, going into the earth and rising again, and I had the very smart, he was smart, very bright student, raised his hand and said, "See, it just proves that all of these religions are the same. And they all have the same myths. And the myths are all like each other. And you can't really believe any one of them. Because they're just, you know, every religion has a myth like this." The response, and I thank Mr. Tolkien for this, you've heard of him, a man who knew something about myth-making, in one of his early friendly arguments with C.S. Lewis, before Lewis had come to the faith, and Tolkien was arguing with him, C.S. Lewis brought up the same argument. You find all of these things in every religion, so they're basically all the same. They're all myths. And Tolkien said to Lewis, and knocked him off his feet, bowled him over, and started the process going in his mind, "They may operate like myths, but Christianity is a true myth." It's an astonishing idea. It operates in some ways on a level as other myths operate. The difference, what separates it from all the others, is it is true. It is not something that is simply made up and invented. It is rooted in history and fact. So that when we talk as Catholics about a God who suffers, dies, and is resurrected, it's historical. It's factual. It may have certain implications that one would find in a myth, but the difference is this is true. It happened. God became incarnate, was human, was crucified, did die, and did rise again. It happened. It's true. Shut the young midshipman up. He didn't know what to say. It started Lewis going, and it's a fascinating and profound idea. The other thing I said was simply this. Do you think God would have sent his son into the world, made himself incarnate in that way in the second person of the trilogy, made the sacrifice on the cross, and indeed risen again from the dead, and not have prepared the world in some way for that? Meaning, why wouldn't the ground be prepared, some sense of it be put in various places, so when the actual event happened, we can turn to the Greeks and see they were grasping after something. That idea was there. Did they make it up? How did they come by it? We don't know. We can't say it for certain. But it's there. And the preparation was there for the actual, true event. Okay? The historical event. Hugely important. Do keep it in mind. All right. Speaking of myth and mythic myths, unlike true myths, got to tell you the background story of the House of Atreus. It isn't pretty. I apologize for this. But part of that communal experience of going to see these plays is everybody who went to the theater knew these stories. There was a time, the world I grew up in, and I'm not that old, although I'm getting there, the world I grew up in had certain stories that everybody knew. Some of them mythic. Everybody knew certain of the Greek myths. Certainly, the biblical stories were true. People knew who Noah was and what the flood was. There were certain historical stories that were true. George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. Everybody knew these things. Communal knowledge is gone. Gone. I can talk to young people who have... There was a flood. Didn't the Army Corps of Engineers get in there to stop it? Okay. They don't know what it is. George Washington chopped down a cherry tree. Did he need cherries? You can buy them in cans at the supermarket. Why did he do that? Okay. There's no communal knowledge anymore. It's simply not there. It's one reason we're isolated. And in isolation, we're easier to manipulate. It's demonic. Okay? It's not a good thing. The Greeks had common knowledge. They knew these stories. Everybody knew them. So when they went to see the Oresteia, they knew the background. We don't. We pick it up. We need the background. This is ugly. This outdoes any soap opera you ever want to see. This is worse than All My Children, which has been running for about 40 years, and it's been very messy. It's terrible what's gone on, but nothing like this. So, Zeus, the head of the gods, has a human side, or at least human desires, and was constantly coming down to earth and getting in trouble. One reason his wife Hera was always upset with him. And he often would come down in the form of an animal and leave children. There are many children in Greek mythology that are the children of Zeus. One of them was named Tantalus. And Tantalus was a favorite of all the gods. Tantalus was particularly attractive. All the gods liked Tantalus. And indeed, Tantalus was given the special privilege of dining with them. In order to return the favor, Tantalus invited the gods to a banquet, and the gods agreed to come, i.e., leaving Mount Olympus and dining with a mortal. Unheard of. Unfortunately, Tantalus was a jerk filled with hatred for the gods. It often happens with those who are privileged, turning against the source of all their privilege. That had happened with Tantalus. So what he did was he killed his own son, Pelops, boiled him in a cauldron, and boiled Pelops was the main course for the banquet of the gods that Tantalus served them when they showed up to dine with him. He apparently assumed that even though they were gods, they wouldn't notice. They were instantly aware of it and were horrified, and punished him by throwing him into Hades, where they put him in a pool of water. And since he had so violated the natural desire for food and drink by what he did, and setting up this horrifying banquet, anytime he tried to drink water from the pool he was in, the pool would be drained. And if he stood up again, the pool would refill. Over his head, hanging fruit branches, apples and pears and pomegranates. But whenever he reached for the tree, the winds would blow it out of reach and he could never get there. So for all of eternity, and it's an eternal punishment, he's thirsty and cannot drink, he is hungry and cannot eat, and therefore when we say something is tantalizing, oh my, look at that filet mignon. Medium rare, served with a fine Bordeaux. That's tantalizing. It means we have this overwhelming urge to consume it. Fortunately, not having committed his offense, we can eat the steak and drink the wine, okay? But that's where the word tantalizing comes from. It comes from this myth. Now, the gods gave restored the sun Pelops. They restored the sun. But the house was cursed. The family line was cursed. Pelops fell in love with a young woman named Hippodamia. Her father had set up a contest in order to win Hippodamia, there had to be a chariot race, and you had to beat the father, who was a brilliant charioteer, okay? And because he was so brilliant and had special horses and a special chariot, any suitor that came for his daughter's hand would lose. And if you challenged the father for the daughter's hand and lost, you were put to death. So Pelops is in love with Hippodamia and comes and asks for the hand in marriage, agrees to the challenge, and the daughter, falling in love with Pelops, decides she knows her father's tricks. So they go to the charioteer, and the one who arranges the chariot, he removes the bolts from the father's chariot wheels. So that the race begins, they head out, and the father's chariot flies to pieces. He is killed. Pelops wins, gets the daughter. You'd think they'd be happily married ever after. Unfortunately, Pelops, being in this cursed line, takes advantage of the chariot worker, treats him miserably, kills him, and the chariot man curses Pelops. We now have a divine curse and a human curse, as if the family didn't have troubles enough, okay? Now the curse is double, divine and human. Pelops has two sons, Thyestes and Atreus. The brothers get along, they're married, Thyestes comes to visit his brother Atreus and commits adultery, seduces the wife of Atreus. It's an outrage. The brother banishes the brother from the house. Thyestes leaves. They are no longer speaking. There is intense hatred between them. And Atreus decides simple hatred is not enough. He has to get vengeance. And we are now in the realm of the Furies, who are all about blood vengeance. You don't forgive, and you don't go to a court of law. You strike back. So Atreus invites his brother back to the house. He says, all is forgiven, and to prove it to you, I'll throw a big banquet, okay? It'll be like the prodigal son coming home. His father forgives him. We have a banquet. There's a difference, though. One comes out of the beauty of the Christian idea and that magnificent sense of forgiveness. Atreus was unforgiving. He kidnaps Thyestes' children, boils them, and serves him his children in a pie. Thyestes' banquet consists of eating his own children. He finds out about it. He's enraged. He curses his brother. Now we have the curse within the family. Divine, human, now within the family. And Thyestes says as well, I'll get back at you, the Furies. Vengeance, revenge, I'll get back at you. Okay? We go to the next generation. Atreus has two sons, Agamemnon and Menelaus. Agamemnon, the hero of this piece. And what happens is the curse is now descending. The curse is descending. The beautiful Helen comes from Troy to visit the house. And Helen is Greek. Paris comes from Troy and visits as a guest. Helen grows up in the house, marries Menelaus, and is seduced by Paris. We have an act of adultery. He carries her back to Troy. And for that reason, Agamemnon and Menelaus decide they must go to Troy, get Helen back, fight the Trojan War. It's all over a woman, the most beautiful woman in the world, we're told. We don't have photographs. There are no films. But she must have been something. She must have been very lovely, okay? See, I hate to do this. We interrupt this story to bring you a joke. I just thought of this. This is a very old joke. I got to tell it. This stuff happens. This is an old joke. A farmer and his family living way out in the countryside never get to the city. They decide they all go to the city. So they go to the city, and the women go shopping, and the older farmer is there with his young son, and they're walking around this incredible department store. I can't believe it. They're walking. They're just in disbelief. And they come up to these two metal doors with numbers up above. they've never seen anything like this. And they see a very elderly woman in a wheelchair come up. She pushes a button and the metal door is open. And she rolls into the, and the door is closed. And they look and it goes 1, 2, 3, 4. And then 4, 3, 2, 1. And the metal door is open and out steps this gorgeous blonde woman. And the farmer turns to his little boy and says, "Son, go get your mother." I'm sorry, it's a good joke. It's a joke you can tell. Okay. Helen was beautiful. She'd been in the elevator. Helen was extremely beautiful. But Menelaus and Agamemnon are ready to go to Troy and they cannot sail. The goddess Artemis has been offended. I can't go into it all. But what happens is, in order for the winds to blow and the ships to go to Troy, Agamemnon is told he must sacrifice his daughter Iphigenia. Artemis demands it. He contacts his wife Clytemnestra, says to her, "I want to say goodbye to my daughter one last time." The daughter is sent to Agamemnon, and he sacrifices his own daughter on the altar. Please notice again the strange twisting of the great true story of Abraham and Isaac. The father who's called on to sacrifice his child makes the sacrifice out of devotion to God himself, and at the last moment, the hand is stayed by the angel. It's a Christian story. This is different. Agamemnon slaughters his own daughter. Goes, the winds blow. He goes to Troy. 10 years of war. The ships come back, and Clytemnestra is enraged, and for 10 years... has had the anger grow in her. She's now ruling the city of Argos. She is controlling the house and is taken as her lover, the son of Thyestes, the brother of Atreus, who's now in the house. And the wife is committing adultery with the son of the... It's horrifying. That's where the play begins. That's where the play begins. What do we have? The basic conflict, then, is indeed real. We are at the end of the 10-year period, and the play opens with the watchman on top of the palace, and we learn he's been there for 10 years without sleeping. This isn't realism, okay? This ain't Ibsen. This is not realism. But the point is, the simple citizens of Argos have suffered while the master has been away. It has been a kind of torture, and it has seemed as if the war would never end. And meanwhile, within the palace, we have the enraged wife and adultery going on. And she is ruled with a strong hand. We hear repeatedly she's ruled like a man, okay? Which tells us something is twisted inside of her. Women should not be like men. Nor should men be like women, although in our current sick modern world, that's an ideal. Whew, may God have mercy on us. The watchman's first words as the play opens, "Dear gods, set me free from all the pain, the long watch I keep, one whole year awake." He's been awake a year. I guess he got a nap. Every year maybe he gets a nap. "Propped on my arms, crouched on the roofs of Atreus like a dog." Please notice the prayer, the play opens with a prayer. Let me emphasize again, one of the principal objects of Aeschylus in all of his writing, as far as we know, is a defense of the way the gods work. He is devout, he believes in them, and even though it is hard to see how they are working, he is defending them. Please notice, the watchman's prayer is answered almost instantly. One can do a fascinating study of these plays by looking at the prayers that take place. And in almost every case, the prayers are answered. I'll say more about that later. So there he is. He's seen, as he said, the stars move across the sky, the great blazing kings of the sky. I know them when they rise and when they fall. And the poetic imagery is telling us about what's going to happen in the play. We're going to see the fall of a great king at the moment he has risen in triumph, having defeated the Trojans. Okay? I wish we had time to do the poetry. The poetry is extraordinary. He sees the signal light. He sees the signal light. And he is absolutely overjoyed. He is free from having to watch. He can tell the mistress of the house. He longs for his king to come home. And then I'll take your loving hand in mine, and the ox is on my tongue. He doesn't dare say anymore. You don't dare speak publicly here around this house. Something's going on. Aye, but the house and these old stones, give them a voice, and what a tale they'd tell. Generations of bloodshed, generations of crime, revenge piled on revenge piled on revenge. And so would I gladly. I'd tell what happened. I'd tell what went on. I speak to those who know. That would have been the audience. To those who don't, my mind's a blank. I never say a word. Doesn't dare speak of it. And in comes the chorus. As I mentioned last night, a chorus of elderly men. Why? Well, they've been left behind. If you want to get into any Greek tragedy, look at who the chorus is. We'll go through this as we look at the chorus changes in each of these plays. Why old men? They're too weak to go and fight. That's the obvious reason. They were the ones left behind. But more than that, what do old men know? They know the past. Old men have memories. They've lived a life. So that the very chorus of this play, when they enter, speak of those past events that cannot be shaken from the house. They know what's going on. They know the horror of it. They're waiting for their king to return, but their minds are going into the past, and what they talk about in that first long, magnificent choral ode, what they're focusing on is the death of Iphigenia, the murder of Iphigenia by her father. What has happened is the princess of the house. They are looking at the moment when she was killed in order for the warriors to go off to Troy. They're hoping the warriors will return, but the very war seems cursed at its outset. A war based on adultery that begins with the sacrifice of the princess in the house in order for the ships to sail, and we get that story told. Now, let me do this quickly. This play is brilliantly constructed. As Aeschylus goes through the Agamemnon, we get the horrible events of what have gone on in recent history told in reverse. We get choruses, and then at the very end, Aegisthus. The choruses talk about the killing of Iphigenia. Then the choruses talk about Helen being carried off by Paris. Then the choruses talk about Helen growing up in the house. Then the choruses talk about, at the end, the horror of that banquet in the house when Atreus, the founder of the house, served the children of Thyestes to the father, and Aegisthus, the son of Thyestes, speaks of it as well. So we are getting reminders of past events as they recede in history. We are going back into the past as the play moves forward. But the play moves forward in terms of plot with the characters looking towards the future, hoping the king will come home, hoping the signals were true, hoping he'll make it home safely, and we learn Menelaus didn't. The gods have been angry, and Menelaus and his ship and many of the Greek ships have been lost at sea in a storm. And then Agamemnon himself arrives and has a huge hope for the future. We'll look at that specifically in a moment. My point is this. The action of the play is moving forward, obviously. We have a plot. But Aeschylus has designed it that as the play and the action of the play moves forwards, what we're reminded of in the choral odes and much of what's talked about is where we're receding into the past. What is he saying? You cannot move into the future and escape your past. You cannot do it. That past is there. And if it is a past of blood and horror and revenge, you cannot just shake it off and pretend it didn't happen. That past is with you as you try to move forward into the future. This is a profound truth. This is a profound truth. And what has happened in every generation is that that blood curse has been passed down from father to son, from father to son, from brother to brother. It is almost as if there is something innate in this family that is wrong, that they cannot escape, that besoils their very being and defines who they are. Wait a minute. Heard of original sin? What we have are the Greeks coming to an understanding that there is something wrong in mankind. There is a curse in mankind. And it isn't something you can just shake off or pretend isn't there, because that curse seems to go from generation to generation to generation to generation. How is it handed down like this continually? We know. We have divine revelation. It's called original sin. But please notice even the way it's posited by the Greeks in this myth. There was a terrible wrong done against the gods way back when, and future generations have to keep paying for it. But they came up with this idea by seeking truth. By trying to look at they didn't have, as I say, divine revelation. But they came to understand a profound truth, which suggests that truth that has been given to us by divine revelation is something we believe it to be true by faith, but if these truth tellers, these truth seekers could come that far in finding a truth that is very like it, that's why it supports our belief. It's not the source of our belief, but it supports our belief. Okay. It indeed turns out to be true. Clytemnestra comes out of the palace. And when she comes, they're asking her, is it true? Is it true? Are the rumors true? And her first great speech. Don't have time to go through it in detail. It's magnificent. Great speech. She describes how it was possible to learn so quickly that Troy has fallen. It's a long way away. Okay? They didn't have the internet. How do we get the news instantaneously? And we learned that great fires had been set on every mountaintop from Troy to Argos. And when Troy fell, this is what the watchman was waiting for. The first fire would be lighted. The one tending the potential wood on the next mountaintop would light his fire. And fire to fire to fire to fire until finally we get to Argos and the watchman sees the closest hill, closest mountain, fire erupts, that's the signal, Troy has fallen. And we get this extraordinary speech by Clytemnestra, it's just wow, breathtaking, of how the signal traveled. Mountaintop to mountaintop to mountaintop to mountaintop, and she ends the speech by saying, and now the true sun of the burning flanks of Ida crashes on the roofs of Atreus's son. Until finally the last fire is lighted and the signal of the fire comes crashing on the roof of the house. Well, what have we got? We have a chain. Fire to fire to fire to fire to fire crashing on the roof of the house of Atreus. Blood to blood to blood to blood crashing on the house of Atreus. Until at the end, the chorus near the end of the Agamemnon, when things have gotten worse, will say, showers of blood falling on the house of Atreus, drowning the house. Fire and blood, crushing the house, drowning the house. How do we get out from under this? It's an extraordinary speech. The point I'm making, every detail in this play. Aeschylus may have been the first dramatist, but boy, we started at the top. What talent. What talent. Just stunning. Now, Clytemnestra has only one worry. She says, if only they are revering the city's gods, the shrines of the gods who love the conquered land, no plunderer will be plundered in return. Just let no lust, no mad desire seize the armies to ravish what they must not touch, overwhelmed by all they've won. I hope they didn't destroy the shrines of Troy, because they'll anger those gods who favored the Trojans. And I hope they didn't plunder the city, carrying off goods that don't belong to them. When the herald shows up, having survived the sea journey, he tells us about what went on in Troy after the victory. Give Agamemnon the royal welcome he deserves. He hoisted the pickaxe of Zeus who brings revenge. He dug Troy down. He worked her soil down. The shrines of her gods and the high altars gone, and the seed of her wide earth he ground to bits. Whoa. No, no, no. We've already been told, you don't do this. Clytemnestra, wicked as she is, has known, I hope he didn't do this. But please notice the word that appears. The notion of revenge. The notion of revenge. It's not just the defeated city, the defeated army, the defeated people, and we won the victory. No, we grind them into the dust. I've got to say a word about another play by Aeschylus. It's one of the most astonishing things ever written. It's called The Persians. I mentioned twice he engaged in battles where the Persians were defeated. He has a play called The Persians in which he very sympathetically treats the defeated people and looks at what is going on in the Persian city and draws an example for his own people, the Greek people. Don't get high and mighty. Don't gloat over victory. Yes, you won a victory, but they are human too. And being defeated, you must remember their humanity. It's one of the most extraordinarily generous pieces of literature ever written. It's forgiving. It's a reminder. You don't crush the opposition. You defeated them. That's sufficient. Well, it's what Agamemnon has done. Meaning, he's coming back with that on his head as well. Okay? Even if the men come back with no offense to the gods, the avenging dead may never rest, says Clytemnestra. And she's talking seemingly about the Trojans and the gods who love the Trojans, but she's also talking about her daughter Iphigenia, this rage that has been burning in her for ages. Now, Agamemnon returns. He is welcomed. And we come to the center of the play, the core of the tragedy. Husband versus wife. Now, let me say this. This is a very good translation. This is a very good translation. The version you're watching is a different translation and is done very well in that it is made more concise. Aeschylus's play is filled with, he's known for, compact, difficult poetry. The audience could understand it, they loved it, okay? It's like Shakespeare's audience. The groundlings may not have understood those long soliloquies, but boy, they love to hear big words and hear people go on like that, okay? It was, wow, why do you say it? I don't know, but it sounded great. Just, that sort of thing. We can assume that the Greek audience has got the complex poetry. For a modern audience, quite sensibly, the translator of the version you're watching simplified things. But it's good. It's there. It's concise. This translator is given the complexity. It's done very well in English. However, the introduction needs to be read with a whole cake of salt. They cannot, they're modern academic intellectuals, they cannot think clearly. They're liberals, they cannot think clearly. There are some very good things in the introduction. There's a lot of if you looked at my version, having reread it recently, you'll see the most common marking in the margin of the introduction is BS. BS2, BS squared, BS tripled, okay? So you've got to be very careful with the introduction. Read the translation. I'd say skip the introduction altogether. Here's the problem, and they keep insisting on it. The tragic hero of the play is Clytemnestra. Excuse me? She's the antagonist. She's the counterforce. This takes me back. I'll share a little story with you. My first full-time teaching job, Temple University in Philadelphia. First course I taught there. I did a course called Political Theater because for me this was a play about politics. I had been trained to be a good liberal. To the good liberal, everything is about politics. There is nothing higher than politics. By the way, the book in which that great Solange Hertz essay on electricity is called Beyond Politics. It's an extraordinary idea in and of itself that in the modern world, there could be things beyond politics. I was a young, stupid liberal. I didn't know. They had trained me well. I went off to teach. I'm spouting liberal nonsense. The first thing I taught in the course was the Oresteia. First time I had ever taught it. I stand up the first day. I'm doing the first class. And I'm talking about poor Clytemnestra, and all the feminists in the classroom, because they were there early on, they were sprouting like snakes from Hydra's head, just one after another. They were saying, poor Clytemnestra. It was a two-hour class. I said, we'll take a little break now. I take the break. And there had been a guy sitting in the back, brooding, staring, glaring. And he stalks up to the podium. And I said, yes. He said, I hope at some point you're going to mention that the play is named Agamemnon, meaning he's the hero of the play. And I said, well, yes, we could discuss that. He said, good. Stalked out the door. Come back 5 minutes later, and I said, Mr. So-and-so, now, would you care to comment why the play is named Agamemnon after this character who only appears briefly in the center? He said, I'll be glad to, and talk for an hour. And it was brilliant. It was brilliant stuff. And I was going, it got to the point, I'm not joking, I would come to class, I'd be teaching whatever, I'd call on him, and I'd stand at the podium and take notes. And I'd say, I didn't quite understand that. Could you explain what you meant? I'd say, oh, no. I was being paid. He was paying to attend my class. That's liberal education. Right there. There you go. To my credit, I listened and took notes. He was in the process of discovering Catholicism. He was in the process of converting and began arguing the Catholic faith with me, starting with the whole Christian story, which I had rejected years ago. I was much smarter than that. It's a myth. It's like all the other myths. We would debate, and I mean debate. It reached the point we would stay all night in my office debating. And he would finally, he'd bring cheesecakes. We'd eat cheesecake all night in the office and debate these stories. Out of that initial argument, I can say it's what led to my conversion. So to be teaching this again now, probably for the last time, it's very moving. These things matter. And I can say to you now, Agamemnon is the hero. He's a tragic hero. He's horribly flawed. Clytemnestra is human. There are grounds for her anger. It's why we have a great play. But the fact of the matter is, Agamemnon is the heroic figure because everything depends on his decision. The future at this point hangs on his decision. And since it's a tragedy, he has a tragic flaw, that is pride. He makes a tragic choice or decision. He chooses to walk on those carpets that she lays out for him. Who cares? It's hugely important because he himself says, when she first rolls out that carpet for him, that he has no business walking on it. Groveling, what am I, some barbarian peacocking out of Asia? Never cross my path with robes and draw the lightning. I walk on those, I'm asking for the judgment of the gods to descend on me. Never, only the gods deserve the pomps of honor and the stiff brocades of fame. To walk on them, I am human, and it makes my pulses stir with dread. There is the greatness of the man. He knows right from wrong. He is aware that to commit such an action is a wrong. But the temptation there is to defy the gods, as every generation going back has done in this cursed family. So the temptation is there. He says, I have a sense of right and wrong. What's more, heaven's proudest gift. When he has returned, he has said what his future plans are is to set up a national tribunal, shore it up with law, and help it flourish. The system of revenge and blood revenge and murder must stop. What do we need? We need law. We need a system of law. We need a tribunal. That's what he's going to do. But the temptation becomes too great, and Clytemnestra seduces him, woos him, convinces him, persuades him to walk on the carpet. It is an exchange of only about 10 lines. Those of you who have the book, it's on page 138. Be true to your ideals. He says, true to my ideals. Once I violate them, I am lost. I can't give up my idea, you know. I can't violate my ideals. Would you have sworn this act to God in a time of terror? Yes, if I was told to do so by a prophet. But Priam, king of Troy, can you see him if he was had your success? Striding on the tapestries of God, I see him now. Yes, he was so evil, he would have done it. That fallen king of Troy, he would have done it. And you fear the reproach of common men? So you're afraid of doing what another king would have done if he had won? The voice of the people, it has enormous power. Perhaps, but where's glory without a little gall? You're a king. You're a victorious king. Forget the common people. Think of what your opponent would have done. And where's the woman in all this lust for glory? But the great victor, it becomes him to give way. Prove you're really a victor and really magnanimous and give way to me. Just one bite of the apple. One little bite of the apple. Please, Adam, please. Oh, come on, just one little bite. No, I shouldn't. I know I can't. It'll be a catastrophe. Oh, just one. What? You don't love me anymore. Do it for me. Oh, man. God. Enough, if you are so determined. He takes his boots off and says, I won't walk on him, at least wearing shoes. And he walks into the house to his doom. He falls. He doesn't attain tragic knowledge the way a tragic hero usually does. That will descend to his son. And again, it's generation to generation in this play. Generation to generation. He goes in, and of course, she has everything prepared. Before he goes, of course, he says, take care of Cassandra, my prize from Troy. He's been committing adultery with a Trojan princess. Oh, by the way, wife, glad to be home. Please take care of my mistress. But of course, she's in the house, committing adultery with the son of, I mean, it's just blood, horror. He's murdered. And Cassandra at the same time. I'm skipping Cassandra. Magnificent character. Beloved of Apollo, he gave her the gift of prophecy. She then withdrew from his love, so he cursed her. And the curse was he couldn't take back the gift. No one would ever believe her. any more than in the Old Testament the prophets are believed. The prophets are never believed. She's a prophetess. She's also very human, very sad. She's lost her family. She's lost her home. She has nothing. She has the gift of prophecy. She knows what's in the house. And indeed, she talks about, she sees the children, she says, holding their entrails, the ones that were killed and eaten. And then she sees hovering above the house, and it's a terrifying vision. These roofs, look up, there is a dancing troop that never leaves, and they have their harmony, but it is harsh. Their words are harsh. They drink beyond the limit. Flushed on the blood of men, their spirit grows, and none can turn away. Their revel breeding in the veins. The Furies! They cling to the house for life. They sing. Sing of the frenzy that began it all. Strain rising on strain, showering curses on the man who tramples on his brother's bed. And she sees the Furies hanging over the house. She makes her farewell, sees her own death, and goes into the house and is killed at the same time Agamemnon is killed. And again, he is killed in the bath, the place of cleansing. A net is thrown over him like an animal, and he is stabbed to death in the bath. Something to do sometime, if you're ever teaching this or want to go through and look at the net and robe and carpet imagery in this play. The whole thing, it's unbelievable. There is a pattern of poetic imagery that's brilliant, that is turned into constantly something actual in the play. The net imagery, we find out, becomes a net that covers Agamemnon. In the Libation Bearers, when Orestes brings out his dead mother and the dead Aegisthus, they're in a net. At the end, when we come to a positive resolution, the Furies are transformed and put on royal robes. It's simply stunning. We're at the end. What has happened? We come to the end. Aegisthus comes out. He's got the power. He feels his father has been justified. The chorus is in agony. Things have gotten worse. It should be a moment of great victory and triumph. The war is over. Their king has come home. Their king is dead. Their king is dead. But they say, still an avenger could arise, bred by the father's crimes, and lend a hand. Orestes may come back. We're looking forward to the second part of the trilogy, which I'll talk about tonight.